All right, welcome to Evaluating the Struggling Student. Our takeaway for this afternoon is dyslexia is a privilege, not a right. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Is that true? Does that statement agree with the Bible? Absolutely not. What does the Bible say? Genesis 1, verse 27, and God created man
in his image.
In the image of God created he him. Now, which one of you here claims to look like God? Raise of hands, please. Two people who feel, but they look quite different. Right? Does God look like Roger? Not necessarily. Or maybe he looks more like Raymond. Which one of us can claim I am the one everyone else needs to look like me, live like me, think like me, or they're not like God? We're created in God's image. But isn't God's image so big that it couldn't fit in any one person? Isn't it obvious that God has created us diversely so that we can see the beauty of his person in the variety of talents he endows on humanity? This topic could just as aptly be called recognizing the struggling teacher. Many of these cases are not a result of students who lack the ability to learn, but of teachers who don't understand people who don't think like I do. In this session, I want to tell you my own story so that you can see how others helped me. Describe the mechanics of dyslexia, acknowledge several other common learning challenges, and identify typical symptoms of dyslexia. I'm a dyslexic teacher named Jonah. I have a wonderful wife and five loving daughters, two of whom are also dyslexic. I've taught for only 17 years, so I still have a lot to learn. In fact, I hope to learn along with you this afternoon. My journey to acquire the ability to read and spell is an ongoing process that began when my father read to us children as we were falling asleep each night. My mother read to us often as she held us. When I was five, we had a little book about a kangaroo and her baby Joey. By begging my parents to repeatedly read this story, I managed to memorize the words that went with each of the pictures and declared that I could read. For my first 2 1/4 years of education, I attended public school where I learned sight reading. If you would please raise your hand so Dan can find you to pass out a handout, that would be helpful. Got one up here as well, Dan. Right here. Yes. Anyone else need one? Thank you, Dan. This worked well for me as I memorized words by their shape rather than by their phonetic components. And yet, it posed a nearly insurmountable obstacle to my little brain. On the other hand, music was a breeze. I could follow round notes, knew the lines and spaces and key signatures, and could play the violin by the age of 6. Our school did some type of standardized testing when I was in 2nd grade. We were told that we could not fail this test. Just do your best, our teachers assured us. But as a result of the test scores, I was bumped back to the slow section of our classroom. This insult so infuriated me that I burst into tears and insisted that I wanted to be in the advanced class with all my friends. My teacher wisely allowed me to be part of the advanced group on a trial basis. The material was far beyond my level of mastery, but I had friends. One in particular, an intelligent lad named E.R. Mosley, came home with me after school every day and explained the challenging concepts in terms I could understand as we did our homework together. With E.R.'s help, I was able to stay in the advanced class and even began to grasp some of the material. During 3rd grade, we transferred to a Mennonite school, and I faced Planet and Rod and Staff 3rd grade reading with its phonics exercises. These challenging concepts based on phonemes, sailed blissfully over my head. My handwriting deteriorated until I couldn't even read it. And my spelling was atrocious. It still is, but it was back then too. My dear teacher struggled to bring me up to speed with my classmates, but found it a losing battle. While slogging through the swamp of lessons, I watched my classmates do flashcards and other exciting forms of drill that sent them skimming across the gator-infested waters with ease, while my boots sank deeper and deeper in the muck of unfinished work and do-overs. To combat my lack of free time in school, I began daydreaming. In my imagination, I could be just as fast and valuable as my classmates. Yet this only widened the chasm between us and left my loving teacher wondering what to do with me. At some point during that year, I heard myself referred to as a slow student. That label changed the way I thought about myself. Maybe I couldn't help being stupid. Well, I remember the day in fourth grade that I brought every subject home from school. Carrying that mountain of books into the house, I realized that this was my problem. That if I wanted to excel at school, I would have to motivate myself. I would need to work harder than my classmates and still get lower grades than they did. I was okay with that. That day began a personal journey to break the bad habits I had developed and to apply myself to learn as much as I could. Another event strengthened my resolve to dig in. During music class, our teacher asked a student in the grade above me to sing the scale. He did. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. She exhibited the correct pitches and asked him to do it again. He did it again. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. In exasperation, she turned to me. Jonah, you take him into the cloakroom and see if you can get this across to him. I did. And as we were successful, I felt like a valued asset to our school, even though my report card contained numbers that resembled winter temperatures in northern latitudes. Sixth grade brought a second eureka moment when I discovered that all the questions I was asking my teacher were covered during class time. My struggle to interpret spoken instructions became a new personal challenge. Listen to my teacher and ask questions during class. It is a testament to the effectiveness of my teacher that in my seventh grade year, I asked only two questions aside from during class time. She was that good. Seventh was also the year that I finally mastered my math facts. Eighth grade signaled the end of my formal schooling, but my eyes had shifted from book learning to the workforce, a theater in which I could perform as well as others. My education suffered as I rushed through my lessons and left school early to go to work several times a week. Classmates dreaded the disruptive tactics I utilized to keep up with them on tough days. You see, on any given day, they could easily whip me at English. My classmates, one of whom sat in front of me, would you please demonstrate? We had those desks with a swiveling seat attached and four legs. When she would leave her seat for something, I would use my feet to slide a library book under one of the back legs, turning the sturdy four-legged desk into a wobbly three-legged one. Would you demonstrate the sound it can make? Does it not want to rock for you? Sorry. Anyway, she struggled to concentrate and even received dirty looks from the teacher for being disruptive. I would then complete my assignment and kindly slide the book out and go on to the next subject. I discovered that another classmate was distracted by the sound of a clicking pen. This action actually stimulated my brain. So when she was nearly finished with an assignment, I would repeatedly click my pen to stall her until I had either caught up or passed her, and then I mercifully would put my pen away and allow her freedom of thought. These may sound like a young man being vexatious, and my teacher did catch me and put a stop to my pernicious ways, but to me, these were coping mechanisms that allowed me to keep up with my peers. I graduated with a large smattering of C's and D's, but I passed. As a young man, I struggled to understand why my friends would enjoy reading so much that they would stay awake at night to finish a thrilling story. I didn't completely stop reading, yet I rarely read anything that didn't have a picture to go with it. My reading fodder consisted of National Geographic's, at least the words under the pictures, Dr. Seuss, The Martyr's Mirror, once again, the words under the pictures, and my Bible. At 16, I developed a desire to write poetry, but I'd forgotten that portion of our English studies. My teacher beamed with satisfaction when I stopped in after school and asked, could I please borrow an English book? I did begin writing, but all my efforts had two things in common. They were short, and the spelling was despicable. An elderly friend of ours, Brother Jerry Troyer, lost a leg to diabetes when I was 18. In an attempt to encourage him as he recovered, I would drive the short distance from their place to their place to have coffee with him after my farm chores were done. He possessed an impressive library and was enjoying it during his convalescence. One stormy morning, as we sipped steaming mugs, he slid two books across the counter to me. You ought to read these, Jonah, he stated. They were graphic books about the Holocaust. I took them home, and just like the martyr's mirror, I found them gripping. The photos drove me to read the text to understand the context for such horrific deeds. I returned these books, and he had another stack to slide across the counter. And so began a beautiful opening of the windows of my mind. New ideas of faraway places and troubled times held me spellbound. 5 years later, my father called and asked if I would consider returning from California for a winter to teach school. Do you really think I can do it? My jaw did its best imitation of a fish. With God's help, I believe you could, Dad assured. My first year was challenging in many ways. The hurdle that threw me for the biggest loop was a sixth grade girl named Gina. She seemed normal in most respects, but daily slogged through her math lessons and typically took everything else home. Her concerned parents discussed this with me, and we decided to limit the amount of time she worked on math at school and have her take that one tough subject home instead of all the others. She consistently performed well in all the other subjects, yet struggled bravely with math. We had a breakthrough when we came to the lesson about sketches. Gina suddenly found a math lesson that agreed with her skill set. Her drawings were all three-dimensional. Absolutely artistic, in fact. I was baffled. So I showed this amazing display of talent to one of my co-teachers. Oh, Marion commented. She must think with the right side of her brain.
The right side of her brain?
Yeah, you see, the right side of the brain thinks in pictures while the left is more logical. Most people favor one side or the other, just like some people are right-handed and others are left-handed. And so I watched Gina the next day and realized that the only thing she really struggled with in math was the reading problems. Marion advised that I should read the problems to her while she visualized them in her mind. It worked. From then on, Gina had almost no homework. Each day I read her reading problems to her in her math lesson, and often she knew the answer by the time I was done talking because she could actually see the problem in her mind. She went on to become a successful teacher. This summer, her faithful husband has been ordained as one of our ministers, and they have a bright young second grader coming to school this fall. At the end of that year, my students scored well on their achievement tests in all except one subject. Anyone want to guess which one that was? Spelling. God called me back into the classroom after I had taken a 3-year sabbatical. A year later, I shuddered at the prospect of teaching first grade for the first time, but I loved it. The following year, our school switched to BSR for our first graders, and as I taught phonemes by using pictures and mnemonics, my spelling began to improve at the tender age of 31. It's still improving. Spelling took a whole new personality to me. Rather than being a random arrangement of arbitrary squiggles, words began to emerge as sensibly assembled components. My journey continues. I still often misspell words in public, but I believe it is a risk worth taking. So I just try to stay tuned to the snickers behind me when I'm writing on a whiteboard. Now for the gift of dyslexia. How many of you are left-handed? Thank you. I'm so glad we have someone here. Does that make you inferior to the rest of us? Or is it just another method of God trying to reveal himself to us? Ephesians 2 verse 10 states, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, unto good works." Listen to the last part. "That God hath before ordained that we should walk in them." God ordained each of us to use the skill set he gave us to do good works. So if you're left-handed, he wants you to do it with your left hand. If you're right-handed, with your right. It's that simple. Rather than deriding these differences, they should be appreciated and valued. In the story of the talents, Jesus suggested that the man with two talents pleased God just as well as the man with five. Like being left-handed, dyslexia is a talent, not a disability. From here on, I'll be stopping to give you a chance to ask questions, so please have them ready, or feel free to eat a meal with us, my wife and I, or corral me during a break, or call me later. The gift of dyslexia. Depending who you ask, 10 to 20% of people are dyslexic to some degree. Dyslexia, like left-handedness, varies in degrees. I am actually semi-ambidextrous. I can hammer with my left hand almost as well as I can with my right. With a little practice, I can sign my name as well with my left as I can with my right. My father writes with his left hand and throws with his right, and so on. Many dyslexics are inventors and creative thinkers. Why would they be that kind of people? A man named Matthew Shelbs said that while the typical reader may tend to miss the forest because its view is blocked by all the trees, people with dyslexia miss the trees but see the forest. How many of you believe that the book Huckleberry Finn is a valuable piece of literature that teaches strong biblical lessons? How many of you believe that the book Huckleberry Finn is anti-slavery? Thank you! I dare you all to read it a second time with that in mind and realize Mark Twain had a point. He was actually mocking the white supremacist ideology and the concept of slavery. Listen to all the profound truths that Jim states in it. To me, it's every bit as powerful as Uncle Tom's Cabin. Visual thinking. Dyslexics do tend to think with their right brain. And in fact, according to pictures taken of dyslexic brains, the right side of a dyslexic brain is physically 10% larger than someone who is non-dyslexic. This does not make them smarter. That's not what we're saying. It does not make them better. It is simply a physical difference, like some people being taller than others, right? We don't consider them more valuable because they're taller. They're just different, all right? Same with that side of the brain. The dyslexics tend to favor this side, which tends to, and this is extremely oversimplified, but the right side of the brain thinks in intuition, pictures, creativity. When I would do reading problems in school, very often I would know the answer by the time I was done reading the problem for the fifth or sixth time when I actually understood the question. And I would not need to write anything on my paper, which drove my teacher rather nuts when I got the answer correctly and there was no problem to show that I'd done anything. And she would ask me, how did you get the right answer? I don't know, but that's the right one. And it was, most of the time. Whereas the left side of the brain thinks in logic. Well, if you had, you know, if you went to the store and you spent this much money, well, then you have to add all these things down and then you subtract them from the amount that you gave the cashier and then you find your change. That's logical, right? The left side thinks in symbols and in words. Visual thinkers tend to have tremendous imagination. When I called Brother Jonathan Erb to talk about this topic, Jonathan said, Jonah, you know, I envy you. I said, why? He said, well, you can see the pizza. Did anybody see pizza on the board? Yes. How many pizzas do you see? Jonathan told me, he said, when someone says pizza to me, I see a little triangle shape with some circles on it, like you might see on a flashcard of a pizza. And I said, Jonathan, you're making me hungry. And he says, why? I said, because this is what I'm seeing. I see a hot piece of pizza and the ends kind of dangling down and there's cheese oozing down the sides and steam coming off the top. And it's just about ready to go in my mouth.
And Jonathan said, I know, it's not fair, is it? But, okay, it's not because I'm better than Jonathan in any way, shape, or form. It's just that we're different. When someone says pizza to Jonathan, that's what he sees. When they say pizza to me, this is what I see. And now I hope we have pizza for supper. All right.
We probably won't, but you can talk to Lillian about that. Accurate dyslexics are able to accurately visualize a project, which makes them excellent architects. They can see the building before it ever gets built. This is why they make excellent painters. They can visualize the whole thing, and they can start putting it out there. It is a gift to be dyslexic. It is not something to think about as a problem in any way, shape, or form, although it does pose some challenges, I admit. They're able to visually memorize things. I have a very photographic memory. In fact, I'm very likely to recognize your face if I see it again in a year or 2 years from now. But my likelihood of remembering your name is horrible. Often memories in my mind are tied to what I saw at the moment something happened. For example, when the 9/11 attacks happened, I was in a furniture shop holding a piece of wood, and I can still see everything that moment. I know it. And that memory will forever be attached to the picture that goes along with it. Dyslexics tend to have much creative ability. They often excel their peers in this, whether it's art or, in my case, at my age, young age, it was music. Once again, it's a gift. It's a gift to be dyslexic. Many of them are good at visual things such as flowers, decorating. Or many boys especially are excellent craftsmen. I had one little boy that came to preschool, 5 years old. And his father talked to me one day. This poor little boy could barely talk at that age. His older brother had to interpret most of what he said because his speech was so garbled. And yet one afternoon when he went home, he completely disassembled their lawnmower down to every nut and bolt. Everything was taken apart. And when his father got home from work, he said, Bryce, that's not okay. We need that thing tomorrow. And the next day when he got home, it was back together at 5 years old. Most dyslexics have abundant energy. Many also have or are diagnosed with what's called ADD, which can be debatably whether that's a problem or not. They're often enthusiastic people, which makes them typically very willing. The average dyslexic will try hard. They want to please. They've got the energy if you can steer it the right way. They may steer that energy the wrong way if you don't get a hold of that and turn the right way. And here's the good part. Dyslexics have a good sense of humor. Right, yeah, good. So dyslexia is a gift. It is not a handicap. It is a difference in the way God created people. And it's for us to see something about him. Any questions? Yes.
About the story problems, is there any other way to help them besides reading it out loud? Is there anything they can do?
Yes, there is. And it is what I used to do as a student in school. My teachers never did that for me. So typically I would read a story problem anywhere from 5 to 8 times. And the reason, I will try to get into this a little bit more Thursday, but many dyslexics need to understand a text. We'll have to read it multiple times, and it's because the first time is so much work. They're spending so much time trying to decode symbols, and we'll talk about that just brief soon here. But it is so much work to decode the symbols that they can't get the words, and once they get the words, it takes them time to decode the thoughts. All right, so people, the average reader, you know, in first grade, we teach them that symbols have sounds, right? And we teach them that those sounds make words, those words make phrases, those phrases make sentences, and those sentences convey thoughts. Well, the dyslexic typically can go through that every single time they read, okay? And when it's a story problem that's presenting
multiple ideas. The dyslexic is going to have to soak each of those ideas. And that is why so often once they actually soak the ideas, by that time they already know the answer. Because they've seen the problem in their mind. They're visualizing, they're seeing the pieces of money. They're seeing the tractor and the trailer or whatever it is that's going on. Any other questions? What did Mr. Mervin said something about quiet workshops? Maybe I need to give you more things to ask about. Let's briefly go on to some of the other maladies that we face in our classrooms. Fetal alcohol syndrome is becoming more and more common in Anabaptist schools as our families adopt children and we then take in some of the world's problems. This may cause symptoms of dyslexia or autism. However, in this case, it is not a situation of a brain created by God to present that difference. This was a brain that was perfectly good by design that was damaged. For example, think of the difference between a four-wheel drive pickup and a two-wheel drive pickup. Those are just different. They have different skills. One of them gets better fuel mileage and so on. That would be the difference between a dyslexic and a non-dyslexic person. Whereas a pickup that has been wrecked and one that hasn't been wrecked. That's what we're looking at with fetal alcohol syndrome and some of these other things that come through babies who are exposed to drugs or alcohol while in their mothers. It is brain damage. Not a different brain, but a good one that had a wreck. And it alters a unique mind that was intended to show us some part of God in a unique way. And a good example of that would be if we've got Roger, and I'm going to pick on Roger and Raymond because they're sitting back here, but if each of them had a concussion, is the resulting confusion and things going to be the same? Well, no. We can know that. No, they will face different symptoms because they started out with a different brain. It's easy for us to see that in a grown person. In children, we see someone says, oh, this child has fetal alcohol syndrome, and so we start thinking, oh, well, we know what's going on. No, it's not that easy. It alters each mind in a unique way, and just like dyslexia, often it's altered in varying degrees depending on how much they were exposed to before birth. Often it inhibits the child's concept of cause and effect, rendering typical punishments often useless. I say that often, not always, but I have found, I'll tell you a few more things about myself. My parents adopted 4 children, all of whom had either fetal alcohol syndrome or were addicted to cocaine when they were born. So this is very personal to me, and they're all different. One of them is very high functioning. She's married, has a child, and can think and reason very, very well. Most people would not know that she had fetal alcohol syndrome as a child. Then the others are in varying degrees down to my next younger brother, who was exposed to copious amounts of cocaine before he was born. He has a vocabulary of somewhere around 150 words. So very profound in his case, and so on. Autism, or also known as Asperger's, is another difference occasionally coupled with genius. This is debatably something that can come naturally. I do have a nephew who has this condition. It hinders verbal and nonverbal communication. These people are often very poor at socially interacting. They don't catch on to social cues. For example, they may not recognize personal space. And so, you know, when they're talking to you, they get up really close, and you hope they brush their teeth. So, but, or they may not catch on when it's time to leave. And things like this. They often don't get other people or pick up on social cues, and yet are extremely intelligent. It does typically hinder their imaginative and creative abilities. They may be extremely smart, and yet if you watch them try to build a fence, you would think that a car hit it. Because they can't, that ability to visualize and put things together has somehow been, is not the same as a typical dyslexics would be. And often they misinterpret sensory processing. For example, my next younger brother, Jeremiah, who was a cocaine baby, they say it has resulted in severe autism. But depending how you touch him, he may scream in pain because he may interpret contact as painful, even if it's not. I can remember him screaming when we put him into warm bath water because it was too overstimulating for him. And then we have slow or fast students who just are naturally that way. I can remember one student when I was in school who just approached life a little bit slower than everyone else did. And he was very happy and has done just fine in life. And there's nothing wrong with him. He's just different. God made him that way. He is extremely intelligent. You just have to give him more time to complete the same task as someone else does. But when he gets done, it's done better. These people sometimes simply lack motivation. Or they might lack speed. God bless you if you try to figure that out. They may misdirect their motivation or intellect. Here again, I have found numerous extremely fast students present themselves as slow students, and the reason is they're bored. They already know everything you're telling them, and they see no reason to work on it. And so they still hand in sloppy, unfinished work. The problem is not that they don't know what to do, or that they don't have the ability. The problem is, they're bored. They actually need a harder problem. And then we also have students who are overly conscientious. A description of this that I found was that a professional versus a perfectionist is that the professional, I mean, they both see the flaws. And if you've ever built something, you know that nothing built or sewn together is perfect, right? But one of them can go on and finish. Ladies, if you're sewing a dress and it misses, your sewing machine misses a stitch somewhere and you have to completely start over, men, if you were nailing and you miss the nail and put a donkey track in the board and then we have to take everything apart, you would never accomplish anything. And that's the difference. Some students need to learn that there is an okay level of variation in outcomes. So it's okay to get a 99 some of the time. I've had students who cried when they did. It's hard to know how to deal with that. Once again, any questions? Yes.
You mentioned that children with fetal alcohol syndrome often don't respond normally to typical punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your advice on how to come up with something that does work?
Here again, I want to spend a lot of time on this on Thursday. In short, the important thing to recognize with them is consistency still does work, all right? So they struggle to connect actions to consequences. That does not mean they cannot. It just means it takes longer. And what also tends to happen with them, they tend to easily become frustrated during a punishment. They may, for example, during a spanking, hit back. All right. If because they hit you back, you keep on spanking, that's actually counterproductive. All right. If you spanked, they hit back, you just stop, walk away, let them cool off. And the next time they do the same thing that initially got them spanked, you spank them again. And does that make sense, sort of? There's, and I will try to spend more time on this Thursday, but basically don't escalate a punishment. They will. Given the opportunity, they will try to raise the stress level, they will push your buttons because they are feeling out of control themselves. Be consistent that, you know, if you pinched someone else, you get a punishment of some kind. But at the same time, don't keep punishing them because they overreacted when you punished them the first time. Once again, we'll try to spend more time on this Thursday. So, yes. Any other questions before we move on?
I did have a question.
Yes.
So I'm not actually, I have a student who's struggling, and I think he was a drug baby.
Gotcha.
And no problems with behavior. Beautiful, wonderful behaved boy, but can't concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
Cannot pay attention unless, there's rare occasions, and I would love some feedback on how to help with that.
There's a book you need to get for him. If I can think of the name, I think it might be called the Davis Method. I will mention that again. There again, I do plan to talk about that specific problem Thursday. So if you're okay, if you can bear with me.
Oh, I can.
I do want to talk about that Thursday. And I can actually give you the tricks that are in that book in short form. But you would, with that type of problem, you'd be better off actually getting the book.
Okay.
So yeah. Going to the last part here, the evidence of dyslexia. Dyslexia is genetic. It is inherited about half the time. And once again, it is typically coupled with brilliance. Not always, but typically. Again, I want you to recognize it as a gift. And in saying that, I do not think that I'm better than other people. It's not. It's just like someone being 6'3" being able to play basketball better than I can. Right? It's not that that person is a better person, but God gave them the gift of a few more inches. And that's okay. Dyslexic struggle with auditory processing. So, when you look up here, what does this say?
Cat.
Really? Okay. This is a curve. This is a circle with a tail. And that is an F, is a cross. Right? It does not say cat. These are what are known as symbols. Right? Uh-oh, problemo. That's the other side of the brain. Right? So, typically, we expect someone to read this as cat, to say these phonemes, right? Cat. And to think this picture. For a dyslexic, it's like trying to ride a unicycle. You know, they get their balance and then they try to steer this thing yet is, it's hard. And so they struggle with this and they finally can get this. And by the time they're there, their brain has worked so hard, they can't think that. But then we get them finally to this. Okay, cat, cat. And then we tell them, cat. Now you write the word. Okay, now they're going backwards. They can see a cat when you say cat. And they can hear the sounds if you slow the word down. Cat. But to change those phonemes back into symbols is extremely challenging because of the fact that you're forcing them to try to take a picture and you're moving it over to here. They're being forced to think their left brain. And just like a left-handed person being forced to write with their right hand. We would say that's not fair. Don't do that. We do it all the time. Okay? That's what we're doing with these dyslexic people. I will talk some more about how we can deal with that Thursday, but today I just want you to understand that this is what's happening. It is actually a problem with auditory processing. It is a problem with their ears. Many people think it's with their eyes. It isn't. actually. How do we know that? We know that because most dyslexics begin showing signs of dyslexia before they can read. They'll say things like aminals, paschetti, mazagine. They've never seen the word. It's what's happening is they've heard those sounds, and when they tried to reproduce those sounds, they couldn't get them in the right order. It is literally a problem with auditory processing. They'll say things like lotion when they mean ocean, or tornado when they mean volcano. I recently called a boy Kendrick when his name is Jarek. And I accidentally said that the Lord was praying in the Garden of Eden before he was crucified. It's almost there. It's almost there. We've got the right idea. These are signs that we can pick up very soon. These can be picked up in a child before they ever show up in the classroom. In the classroom, they will have trouble spelling. That is like the number one sign that someone is dyslexic is a problem turning those phonemes back into symbols. And it's because we're trying to force that mind to do something it doesn't usually do.
So are they doing that by memory then when they do it right?
Many times. For example, I used to spell this word remembering that it looks like a train engine. And I was spelling it by the shape I saw in my mind rather than the letters that it made. You can't see it? There you go. That's what I see when I see that word every time. Typically, this surfaces by second grade. Most teachers and parents have figured out that there's a problem by the time these children hit second. They have trouble with written expression. In my case, they can't, and this is very typical, they can't even use spell check consistently. It took me years before I could consistently get my computer to give me this word. I couldn't make it happen. And even today, occasionally, I will skip using a word because my computer can't even figure out what I'm trying to write. And they cannot prove their intelligence on paper, but they can speak. You tell them to, for example, write out a sentence that has a direct object and things that you've bombed them. Because we're trying to get them to turn this stuff into symbols. And their mind is just overloaded. They typically do have trouble reading. And once again, that is this situation of changing symbols into phonemes into thoughts. It's extremely challenging for them. That typically shows up by third grade. They'll confuse the letters B and D, and sometimes even the letter P. And they'll get them all mixed up. Often, they work slowly, or we think they are. The reason is because they're doing so many more steps before they do the same thing that someone who's thinking with their left brain is doing. And often they are directionally challenged. Many of these students will struggle with their left and right. Wait. See, it all depends on who's talking, right? Is it left and right, or is it left and right? Or, wait a minute, it's left and right. Lord willing, tomorrow I will tell you a story about someone who had that particular problem that he couldn't tell what was left and right because it all depended which way he was facing. Or directions. The directions north, south, east, and west. Multi-step instructions. And then here again, multi-step instructions, you know, you copy this and then you write that and something like long division, where you have four or five steps. When every step involves decoding symbols and turning them into phonemes and ideas, many times these students hit a brick wall because one instruction is hard enough. And many of them are memory challenged. And when I say that, they are memory challenged in rote memory. For example, 1 plus 1 equals 2. What picture do we have for 1 plus 1 equals 2? But now if we say one dog plus two dogs equals two dogs, then they're okay. And once again, I do hope to help with that. They tend to have no problem with narrative memory. They can remember a story perfectly. But math facts, spelling rules, and Bible verses sail blissfully over their little heads. Any questions?
Does dyslexia come in levels?
It does. It does, very much so. So typically they would say mild, moderate, and profound. I'm probably somewhere between mild and moderate. A profound dyslexic typically, even at my age, would very much struggle to read. In fact, the man who wrote the Davis Method did not learn to read till he was 38. He's considered a profound dyslexic. The child who Susan Barton wrote the Barton program for was a profound dyslexic at how old was he again? I think he was 16 or so before he learned to read. So there are levels. And mild dyslexia typically can be treated just fine in a normal classroom with a few classroom accommodations. Moderate, even close. Once it goes beyond that, typically they need other curriculum, some special ed, and that kind of thing. But we'll get into that, Lord willing, more Thursday as well. Any other questions?
Do you highly recommend the Barton
program? Do I highly recommend the Barton program? Case basis. It works for students who need it. Does it fix every problem? No. And is it always appropriate? No. Particularly not if the parents are not on board. Lord willing, tomorrow night again, I will tell a story relating to that. In closing, dyslexia is a privilege because it's a gift from God that reveals His creative abilities. In a different way of thinking, it is a different way of thinking and should be approached with different teaching methods wherever possible. Other maladies also enter our classrooms, and each deserves to be valued as a person originally created in the image of God, even if their mind was damaged by alcohol or drugs. So Lord willing, Thursday, I'll give you some remedies. Tomorrow night, Lord willing, I'll just be telling you stories. Thank you for your attention.